TED Audio Collective.
You're listening to TED Talks Daily. I'm Elise Hugh. Coronavirus has killed more than 500,000 people worldwide, and the virus continues to overwhelm the U.S. and several developing countries. Today, head of TED Chris Anderson interviews the technologist and philanthropist Bill Gates. Gates helps us understand what's happening with the pandemic, what makes COVID so novel, and what researchers are doing to knock down the virus's numbers. And this talk today, it's longer than our usual, but it's worth sticking with. Bill Gates takes some time to address some conspiracy theories circulating about himself, which is pretty great. Support for TED Talks Daily comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/TED Talks. That's odoo.com/TED Talks. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Canva presents unexplained appearances. It was an ordinary workday until...
that presentation appeared out of thin air.
Also, it's eerily on brand.
Wait, did that agenda just write itself?
Words appear, making this unexplainable case...
unexplainable? It's Canva's AI tools.
I can generate slides and words in seconds.
Really? The real mystery is why I'm only learning this now.
Canva.com, designed for work.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
We have an amazing conversation today with none other than Bill Gates. He has become one of the most trusted voices on this pandemic and where it's heading and what we might do about it. After all, it's been a topic, along with public health, a topic of fascination for him for many years. He gave a great TED talk about it 5 years ago, warning the world. He has access to the world's best scientists. He's really good at converting what they say into understandable English. And he has a foundation able to do a lot of interventions relevant to it. So it's always exciting talking with him. Welcome, Bill Gates.
Thank you.
All right. It's great to have you here, Bill. You know, we had a TED conversation about 3 months ago about this pandemic. And back then, fewer than 1,000 people in the US had died and fewer than 20,000 worldwide. I mean, the numbers now are like 128,000 dead in the US and more than 500,000 worldwide in 3 months. What is your diagnosis of what is possible for the rest of this year? You look at a lot of models. What do you think best and worst case scenarios might be?
Well, the range of scenarios, sadly, is quite large, including that as we get into the fall, we could have death rates that rival the worst of what we had in the April time period. And if you get a lot of young people infected, eventually they will infect old people again. And so you'll get into the nursing homes, the homeless shelters, the places where we've had a lot of our deaths. The innovation track, which you know probably we'll touch on, diagnostics, therapeutics, vaccines, there's good progress there. But nothing that would fundamentally alter the fact that this fall in the United States could be quite bad. And that's worse than I would have expected a month ago. The degree to which we're back at high mobility, not wearing masks, and now the virus has gotten into a lot of cities that it hadn't been in before in a significant way. So it's going to be a challenge, you know. There's no case where we'd get much below the current death rate, which is about 500 deaths a day. But there's a significant risk we'd go back up to the even 2,000 a day that we had before, because we don't have the distancing, the behavior change to the degree that we had in April and May. And we know this virus is somewhat seasonal, so that the force of infection, both through temperature, humidity, more time indoors, will be worse as we get into the fall.
So there are scenarios where in the US, like if you extrapolate those numbers forward, we end up with what, more than a quarter of a million deaths per chance, even this year, if we're not careful. And worldwide, I guess the death toll could, by the end of the year, be well into the millions with an S. Is there evidence that the hotter temperatures of the summer actually have been helping us?
They're not absolutely sure, but certainly the HME model definitely wanted to use the season, including temperature and humidity, to try and explain why May wasn't worse than it was. And so as we came out and the mobility numbers got higher, the models expected more infections and deaths to come out of that. And, you know, so it's, and we see in the Southern Hemisphere, you know, Brazil, which is the opposite season, all of South America is having a huge epidemic. South Africa's having a very fast-growing epidemic. Fortunately, Australia and New Zealand, the last countries in the Southern Hemisphere, are at really tiny case counts. And so although they have to keep knocking it down, you know, they're talking about, oh, we have 10 cases, that's a big deal, let's go get rid of that. So they're one of these amazing countries that got the numbers so low that test, quarantine, and trace is working to get them, keep them at very near zero.
Aided perhaps a bit by being easier to isolate and by less density, less population density, but nonetheless, smart policies down there.
Yeah, everything is so exponential that a little bit of good work goes a long ways. It's not a linear game. Contact tracing, if you have the number of cases we have in the U.S., it's super important to do, but it won't get you back down to zero. It'll help you be down, but it's too overwhelming.
Okay, so in May and June in the U.S., the numbers were actually slightly better than some of the models predicted, and it's hypothesized that that might be partly because of the warmer weather. Now, we're seeing really, would you describe it as really quite alarming upticks in case rates in the U.S.?
That's right. It's in, say, the New York area, the cases continue to go down somewhat, but in other parts of the country, primarily the South right now, you have increases that are offsetting that. And you have testing positive rates in young people that are actually higher than what we saw even in some of the tougher areas. And so clearly younger people have come out of mobility more than older people have increased their mobility. So the age structure is right now very young. But because of multi-generational households, people who work in nursing care homes, unfortunately, that will work its way back, both the time lag and the transmission back up into the elderly will start to push the death rate back up, which is down, you know, way down from 2,000 to, you know, around 500 right now.
And is that partly because there's a three-week lag between case numbers and fatality numbers? And also perhaps partly because there have been some effective interventions and we're actually seeing the possibility that the overall fatality rate is actually falling a bit now that we've gained some extra knowledge?
Yeah, certainly your fatality rate is always lower when you're not overloaded. And so Italy, when they were overloaded, Spain, even New York at the start, certainly China, there you weren't even able to provide the basics, the oxygen and things. A study that our foundation funded in the UK has found the only thing other than remdesivir that is a proven therapeutic, which is the dexamethasone, that for serious patients is about a 20% death reduction. And there's still quite a pipeline of those things. You know, hydroxychloroquine never established positive data, so that's pretty much done. There's still a few trials ongoing. And so you always have, when you talk about death rates, the good news is some innovation we already have, and we'll have more even in the fall. We should start to have monoclonal antibodies, which is the therapeutic, the single therapeutic that I'm most excited about.
Just putting the pieces together on death rates. So in a well-functioning health system, so take the US when places aren't overcrowded, what do you think the current fatality numbers are approximately going forward, like as a percentage of total cases? Are we below 1% perhaps?
If you found every case, yes, you're well below 1%. People argue, you know, 0.4, 0.5. You know, by the time you bring in the never symptomatics, it probably is below 0.5. And, you know, that's good news. This disease could have been a 5% disease. The transmission dynamics of this disease are more difficult than even the experts predicted. The amount of pre-symptomatic and never symptomatic spread, and the fact that it's not coughing, where you would kind of notice, hey, I'm coughing. Most respiratory diseases make you cough. This one, in its early stages, it's not coughing. It's singing, laughing, talking. Actually, still, particularly for the super spreaders, people with very high viral loads, causes that spread. And that's pretty novel. And so even the experts have to say, wow, this caught us by surprise. The amount of asymptomatic spread and the fact that there's not a coughing element is not a major piece like the flu or TB.
Yeah, that is devilish cunning by the virus. I mean, how much is that non-symptomatic transmission as a percentage of total transmission? I've heard numbers it could be as much as half of all transmissions are basically pre-symptomatic.
Yeah, if you count pre-symptomatics, then most of the studies show that's like at 40%. And, you know, and we also have never symptomatics. The amount of virus you get in your upper respiratory area is somewhat disconnected. Some people will have a lot here and very little in their lungs. And what you get in your lungs causes the really bad symptoms and other organs, but mostly the lungs. And so that's when you seek treatment. And so the worst case in terms of spreading is somebody who's got a lot in the upper respiratory tract, but almost none in their lungs, so they're not care-seeking.
Right. And so if you add in the never symptomatic to the pre-symptomatic, do you get above 50% of the transmission is actually from non-symptomatic people?
Yeah, transmission is harder to measure. You know, we see certain hotspots and things, but that's a huge question with the vaccine. Will it, besides avoiding you getting sick, which is what the trial will test, will it also stop you from being a transmitter?
And maybe, Bill, use this as a moment to just talk about where the quest for the vaccine is and what are just some of the key things we should all be thinking about as we track the news on this.
There's three vaccines that are, if they work, are the earliest. The Moderna, then you have the AstraZeneca, which comes from Oxford, and the Johnson & Johnson. Those are the three early ones. And we have animal data that it looks potentially good, but not definitive, particularly will it work in the elderly. And we'll have human data over the next several months. Those three will be gated by the safety and efficacy trial. That is, we'll be able to manufacture those, although not as much as we want. We'll be able to manufacture those before the end of the year. Whether the phase three will succeed and whether it'll complete before the end of the year, I wouldn't be that optimistic about. You know, phase three is where you need to really look at all the safety profile and efficacy, but those will get started. And then there's four or five vaccines that use different approaches that are maybe 3 or 4 months behind that. Novavax, Sanofi, Merck. And so we're funding factory capacity for a lot of these. Some complex negotiations are taking place right now on this to get factories that will be dedicated to the countries, the poorer countries. It's called low and middle income. And the very scalable constructs that include AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. We'll focus on those, the ones that are inexpensive, and you can build a single factory to make 600 million doses. So a number of the vaccine constructs are potential. You know, I don't see anything before the end of the year. That's really the best case.
Bill, is it the case that if you and your foundation weren't in the picture here, that the market dynamics would likely lead to a situation where as soon as a promising vaccine candidate emerged, the richer countries would basically snap up, gobble up all available initial supply. But that what effectively you're doing by giving manufacturing guarantees and capability to some of these candidates, you're making it possible that at least some of the early vaccine units will go to poorer countries. Is that correct?
Well, it's not just us, but yes, we're in the central role there, along with the group we created called CEPI, Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness. And the European leaders agree with this. Now, we have the expertise to look at each of the constructs and say, okay, where is there a factory in the world that has capacity that can build that? Which one should we put the early money into? What should the milestones be where we'll shift the money over to a different one? Because the kind of private sector people who really understand that stuff, some of them work for us, and we're a trusted party on these things, we get to coordinate a lot of it, particularly that manufacturing piece. Usually, you'd expect the U.S. to think of this as a global problem and be involved. So far, no activity on that front has taken place. I am talking to people in the Congress and the administration about when the next relief bill comes along, that you know maybe 1% of that could go for the tools to help the entire world. And so it's possible, but it's unfortunate. And you know the vacuum here, the world is not that used to, and a lot of people are stepping in, including our foundation, to try and have a strategy, including for the poor countries who will suffer a high percentage of the deaths and negative effects, including their health systems being overwhelmed. You know, most of the deaths will be in developing countries, despite the huge deaths we've seen in Europe and the U.S.
I mean, I wish I could be a fly on the wall and hearing you and Melinda talk about this, because of all of the ethical crimes, let's say, executed by leaders who should know better. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, not model mask wearing, but to not play a role in helping the world when faced with a common enemy respond as one humanity and instead, you know, catalyze a really unseemly scramble between nations to fight for vaccines, for example. That just seems that surely history is going to judge that harshly. That is just sickening, and isn't it? Am I missing something?
Well, it's not quite as black and white as that. The U.S. has put more money out to fund the basic research on these vaccines than any country by far. And that research is not restricted. There's not like some royalty that says, hey, if you take BARDA money, you have to pay the U.S. a royalty. They do, to the degree they fund research, it's for everybody. To the degree they fund factories, it's just for the U.S. The thing that makes this tough is that in every other global health problem, you know, the U.S. totally leads smallpox eradication. The U.S. is totally the leader on polio eradication with, you know, key partners, CDC, WHO, Rotary, UNICEF, our foundation. And on HIV, what under President Bush's leadership, but it was very bipartisan, this thing called PEPFAR was unbelievable. You know, that has saved tens of millions of lives. And so it's that the world always expected the U.S. to at least be at the head of the table financially, strategy. Okay, let's, you know, how do you get these factories for the world, even if it's just to avoid the infection coming back to the U.S. or to have the global economy working, which is good for U.S. jobs, to have demand outside the U.S. And so the world is kind of you know, there's all this uncertainty about which thing will work. And there's this, okay, who's in charge here? And, you know, so the worst thing, the withdrawal from WHO, that is a difficulty that hopefully will get remedied at some point, because we need that coordination through WHO.
Bill, I want to ask you something about what it's been like for you personally through this whole process, because weirdly, even though your passion and good intent on this topic seems completely bloody obvious to anyone who's spent a moment with you, there are these crazy conspiracy theories out there about you. I just checked in with a company called Signal that monitors social media spaces. They say that to date, on Facebook alone, more than 4 million posts have taken place that associate you with some kind of conspiracy theory around the virus. I read that there was a poll that more than 40% of Republicans believe that the vaccine that you would roll out would somehow plant a microchip in people to track their location. I mean, I can't even believe that poll number. And then some people are taking this seriously enough, and some of them have even been recirculated a bit on Fox News and so forth. Some people are taking this serious enough to sort of make really quite, you know, horrible threats and so forth. You seem to do a good job sort of shrugging this off. But really, like, I don't, who else has ever been in this position? How are you managing this? What on earth world are we in that this kind of misinformation could be out there? What can we do to help correct it?
I'm not sure. And, you know, it's a new thing that, you know, there's conspiracy theories. I mean, Microsoft had its share of controversy, but at least that related to the real world. Did Windows crash more than it should? And, you know, we definitely had antitrust problems, but at least I knew what that was. When this emerged, I have to say, my instinct was to joke about it. People have said that's really inappropriate because this is a very serious thing. It is going to make people less willing to take a vaccine. And of course, once we have that vaccine, it'll be like masks, where getting lots of people, particularly when it's a transmission-blocking vaccine, there's this huge community benefit to widespread adoption of that vaccine. And so I am caught a little bit unsure what to say or do, because the conspiracy piece is a new thing for me. And, you know, what do you say that doesn't give credence to the thing? The fact that a Fox News commentator, you know, Lauren Ingram, was saying this stuff about me microchipping people, that survey isn't that surprising, because that's what they heard on the TV. It's wild. And people are clearly seeking simpler explanations than, you know, going and studying virology.
I mean, Ted is non-political, but we believe in the truth. I would say this, Laura Ingram, you owe Bill Gates an apology and a retraction. You do. And let's look at the actual problem of solving this pandemic. Well, Bill, you know, I'm in awe of what you and Melinda have done. You know, you walk this narrow path of trying to juggle so many different things, and the amount of time that you dedicate to the betterment of the world at large, and definitely the amount of money and the amount of passion you put into it. I mean, it's pretty awesome. And I'm really grateful to you for spending this time with us now. Thank you so much. And honestly, the rest of this year, your skills and resources are going to be needed more than ever. So good luck.
Well, thanks. It's fun work, and I'm optimistic. So thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Bill.